This is John Udell. For today's podcast, I got together with CJ Rahill. She's the CIO of O'Reilly & Associates and is one of the people spearheading a new project called Safari U. We talked about how Safari U enables college professors to create custom books online for their computer science students and then have those books printed out on demand. We also talked more broadly about the educational possibilities of search and of multimedia technologies like podcasting and screencasting.
CJ speaking.
Hey CJ, this is John. How you doing?
Good. How are you, John?
I'm doing fine.
Good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, likewise. I wanted to, first of all, talk through what your experience has been with Safari U. And even though I'll explain this up front, I should just mention here that at one time I had a consulting relationship with O'Reilly in the beginning of the Safari project, but am not now involved with it and haven't been for, what is it, about 4 years or so.
Right.
But in that time, you left your position as CIO to spearhead the Safari U project, which is, I would say briefly, educational print on demand combined with Safari like online access to books.
Correct. I actually didn't leave my position as CIO, and as normally as we do in small companies, you just get an extra hat to wear.
Oh, okay.
but okay. What happened was, I actually came into O'Reilly at the end of 2000, and they were just getting ready to launch the Safari Books Online service, and that was the project you had worked on and where you and I met each other.
That's right.
And that's been our fastest growing product since that point in time. So that's wildly been a success for us. I think if I could put things in perspective of this discussion, I would ask the listeners to kind of think of a two-axis graph, right? One axis is really, call it free to, paid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the other axis is packaged to atomic.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about publishers today, especially publishers in a niche like O'Reilly is in terms of really publishing more in just the technology angle of things, where folks are more and more looking to Google for answers, we really have a lot of concerns about what the future holds for us. And when you look at the world in terms of the quadrants of those two axes, the world is kind of pushing us as publishers, especially as reference and technology type publishers, down to the lower quadrant, which is basically free and atomic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the challenge for us is figuring out, what kind of business models can we survive with in the future? And are there other ways or other business models that can fit into those other quadrants? Are there different ways of repackaging what we do and reusing what we do to provide value-added services?
Mm-hmm.
So about 3 years ago, it was one of those situations where we noticed, there was a big downturn and we still hadn't hit bottom yet. And we noticed that the other publishers who, were much larger than we were, got nice little bumps twice a year when the school year starts.
Mm-hmm.
And we had traditionally not looked at the academic market as something to consciously go after, although...
Which I think surprises a lot of people, because it would seem like a natural fit for a whole bunch of different computer science kind of courses. Obviously, people are using your books anyway, so...
Yeah, they do, but here's what we found out. What we found out was that, as you well know, John, our books are very practical, right? So when it comes to, like, tech schools or the JCs or community colleges where they're teaching very, very practical level type of technology courses, our books were adopted more readily as primary text.
Yeah.
But what we found in, like, the four-year colleges and things like that, they teach a lot of theory, and our books and content aren't really about theory. They're about the practical applications of theory, although they do cover it.
I'm not sure that speaks necessarily well for those universities.
I somewhat agree, but I think, once folks get the theory, the schools kind of leave it up to the students to look at ways to apply it, or they do it more in experiential type teaching, give them a project where they have to apply it.
That's a serious question, as a matter of fact. I have a friend, Greg Wilson. He's at a Canadian university, and he's been very concerned with the fact that people are going through these computer science curricula and not absorbing all sorts of basic skills that have to do with being competent in the software realm, having to do with understanding CVS or Subversion or project management or the social aspects of negotiating a specification or the general very real problem of how you dive into a code base that's new to you and learn your way around and get competent working in it.
Which is usually the first jobs you get, right? I mean, you're thrown into a system that already exists and you're told, you know, you're going to do maintenance work in it.
Yes.
And most
yes.
of these folks coming out of, you know, university are used to just building their own thing from the ground up and looking at their own code. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the perfect example I would give you is my nephew, about 3 years ago, graduated from the SUNY system. And after his second year, I believe, of college, and he was a computer science mm-hmm. major, I brought him out here, and I was affiliated with a startup, and I had him intern at the startup. And after his summer of, you know, interning with the company, he came back to me and he said the biggest gap that he saw in his education up to that point, you know, he's you know, halfway through his higher education, is the database aspect, right? So there wasn't any focus on it
mm-hmm.
throughout his curriculum,
mm-hmm.
and yet he said 95% of the work that he did when he was within a business environment, quote-unquote, had to do with information and data. And he said he wouldn't have learned any of that had it not been for interning and realizing that the gap between what he was learning theoretically and what he really needed to know to get work done in a business environment was huge.
Yeah. Werner Vogels, who's the CTO of Amazon, made the same point recently. He wrote, actually, he was interviewed, I think, in ACMQ, interviewed by Jim Gray, actually, the Microsoft researcher. And it's a fascinating piece. Among other things, he talks about how people come out of colleges with a theoretical background, but that there are no colleges that have infrastructures that resemble Amazon or its peers. And so in terms of learning to deal with galactic scaling issues in the real world, there's just no way other than to be in the environment.
Well, that's why I think also interning and mentoring is such a critical part of you know, folks going through that curriculum as well.
Yeah.
I believe it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But anyways, getting back to kind of where we were with it, Tim kind of asked for a volunteer to look at how we as a publisher might more consciously or strategically approach the academic market. And I think it was one of those situations where everybody else stepped backwards and I was the last one standing. But so, you know, I volunteered, and Alan Noren, who had just come back from a leave of absence, agreed to kind of dive into this area with me and figure out what we might be able to do.
Yeah.
And typical O'Reilly approach, we just got in contact with literally hundreds of what we call FOOs, Friends of O'Reilly, who were in the academic setting, everything from four-year universities to community colleges, adjunct faculty, and also corporate trainers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, folks who are independent and go out and train in the corporate environments. And we just conducted just hundreds of interviews and very open interviews, just saying, you know who we are, you know what our content is like, you know that our brand recognition isn't as visible as we'd like it to be in the higher education market, and for that matter, sometimes in the corporate training market. So what could we do as a publisher to help you? And after compiling all of the interview results, it was very clear to us that there were three or four very common themes that were coming back. One was that educators wanted a one-stop shop, didn't want to go to multiple places, didn't want to deal with copyright hassles for multiple publishers or having to go to, you know, the Copyright Clearance Center for one thing and directly to the publisher for another.
They wanted it to come through the college bookstore like they're used to, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Or basically, the bottom line is they wanted it to be somebody else's problem, right?
Yeah.
They wanted one place to go for really good quality content that they could put together for their students and not have all the hassles of trying to get, you know, fair rights use and all that kind of stuff for it.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that they told us, which was a little bit surprising, and, you know, I guess we're usually on the bleeding edge, so it just came as an interesting surprise to us, but maybe not to others, was that they wanted the ability to mix and match that content in their own pedagogical way and deliver that to students, but do it in either or both a print and or online format. And we were kind of thinking, oh, these are, you know, computer science, information tech instructors. They'll want everything online. And a recent survey that was just completed, I believe, by the National Association for College Bookstores found that over 80% of students still preferred print, which was surprising to me given that, you know, the upcoming generations were kind of brought up in an online world.
Well, there's really two different modes of absorbing information. One is search tactically, right? And the other is kind of strategically step back and take in a chunk of stuff. And in the latter mode, I think most people would rather read print.
I know that I do, but the more and more I watch my, you know, nieces and nephews and the younger folks interact with each other, I was just surprised to hear that. It's encouraging to us as a publisher, but nonetheless, we didn't feel like we could just go forward with some kind of online solution. We felt like we needed to incorporate a print component to that solution. And then the third thing we heard was that, you know, they've spent a lot of time and effort in putting together their own materials for teaching. And the ability to incorporate those in, you know, in these compilations or pedagogies that they're putting together was critical. And they also felt there was another layer of value in that the compilation itself becomes an extra value layer of how might you approach teaching a certain subject. And don't forget that people are teaching in all kinds of different time frames these days. So the way I might approach, you know, introduction to programming using Java or something for a summer course would be very different than how I approach it for a full semester course.
Right. So obviously they were already, most of them, in a pretty good position to put their own stuff online and make it available to people, but probably not in a good position to have that stuff flow out in the print-on-demand fashion, never mind combined with other more conventional print materials.
Right, and in many cases, we found that they were just linking to things and telling students, just go print it yourself if you want it.
Right.
You know, which really didn't address some of the students' issues and needs as well. So we took that feedback, and by the way, they also said that the ability to share all of those, you know, for lack of a better term, playlists with other educators in some kind of, you know, socialized network would be an advantage to them as well.
Yeah.
So we took all that feedback and we kind of looked around for, you know, what assets we had in the company. And, of course, we had been running Safari at that point in time for about 4 years. And we said, well, we already have our content online. Is there a way for us to leverage this platform in such a way to provide these types of services to folks? So in our initial beta version that we put out, we took the Web 2.0 adage of, you know, many pieces loosely joined, and we literally pieced together three different platforms, one being the Safari Books Online platform, the other being a kind of put together a pod book type of platform with a manufacturing partner, and then the third is kind of all the rest of the stuff that we had to build ourselves. And we literally just hooked them all together with web services. And we rolled that out in January of 2005. We got about, I'd say, 4 or 5 months of feedback under our belts and realized that the user interface that was necessary because we were piecing these things together very loosely could get very confusing. So we literally started to build version 2, and as you well know, you know, you never build the best thing first. You always, you know, build it the second time around. And recently just launched our V2 version to, you know, in a non-beta fashion, if you will, at the end of March of this year.
So the partner relationship is quite interesting here. Are you able to say who they are? Or?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it may be confusing because we're all using the term Safari as well, but first of all, it's not the browser. Second of all, Safari Books Online, the service, is actually a separate company. It's a joint venture between ourselves and Pearson. And there are two products that recently have been spun off from that joint venture. One is Safari U, as I just mentioned, in which, you know, it's really we're the lead on that project, we being O'Reilly, but Pearson is participating with us. And then Safari X is Pearson's project or product that they are taking the lead on, to which we are participating in. Safari X is a different library. It's Pearson's textbooks, and it's their response to trying to bring value to students in that they allow subscriptions to a single book for half the retail price.
Okay.
But they're all kind of based off that same platform architecture model of the electronic book, if you will, and accessibility to it.
And then who is the partner that handles the print on demand and has the relationships with the college bookstores?
Originally, our print on demand partner was Ames On Demand out of Cambridge.
Okay.
Somerville, I think,
okay.
Outside of Boston. However, with the version 2 of this, we've actually taken all the components that, you know, we used in terms of their platform and rebuilt them ourselves in a very integrated fashion.
Hmm.
So what we have in V2 is an extremely integrated type product, very tightly integrated, so that from a UI perspective, you know, there's a single window where getting access to all of the services and products. And it's built on a product called MarkLogic, which is the XML database engine that's underneath it all.
Yeah, I got very interested in that product and did a bit of development with it about a year or so ago and was quite impressed.
And what's really interesting about all this, John, and by the way, we've been, you know, getting very good response on SafariU. I really think it's one of those things that it's so new and such a new concept for folks of, you know, they can do it themselves, they don't need a sales rep, they can deliver the content to their students in lots of different ways, that it takes a while for them to absorb that and you know, kind of try something new per se, right? But
so who's owning the relationships to the bookstores now? Because that was Ames originally?
No,
we
did all that. We actually, from the very beginning, handled all the customer service and order entry and processing. We use some of their systems to do that. We now handle all that in-house ourselves. So we interact directly with the bookstores. They place their orders with us. We fulfill those orders.
Oh, okay.
Now, we do use a pod manufacturer who does the actual printing and you know, ultimate delivery.
Okay.
But we manage the process here, and it's all integrated into our systems at this point.
And what's been your experience working with the bookstores in terms of the level of web services and relationship that's possible?
Wow. There's really a twofold world out there when it comes to bookstores. There are those bookstores that universities and schools have basically given over to you know, retail players like B&N to manage, right? And so they have pretty wide networks and pretty good technological capabilities. And then there are those that are still school-sponsored.
Right.
And don't forget that schools actually get a pretty large dollar amount kind of subsidized through sales and things at their bookstores, which is one of the reasons why they still want to flow a lot of things through there and not cut out that middleman, if you will.
Yep.
So we took the approach that we wanted to work with the bookstores. We didn't necessarily want to cut them out of the picture for many of those reasons. And they've been very responsive to us. I'd say the only sticking points are that we're talking about custom books, right? And so the industry standard in terms of returns on custom books is around 10%. So what happens is either A, they're very conservative about ordering, or B, they, you know, jack up the price quite heavily.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those are two drawbacks from going through that. We are also looking at direct delivery options in the future, but we decided out the gate that we really wanted to treat them more as partners than as necessarily adversaries.
So just to talk through the scenario then, I'm Professor So-and-so and I'm doing CS 101 at some school, and I decide that I want to combine selections from three or four different O'Reilly and or Pearson books in a custom offering that I'm going to require the students to read, so it's going to show up at the bookstore, right, as part of CS 101's syllabus. So I make the selections online through your application, and then the order flows
happens is they complete their project online, and it gets assigned an ISBN.
Oh, it does.
And we are notified that the instructor has, in fact, completed a project and placed an order, quote-unquote.
Yep.
We hold that order on our end until we see the purchase order come through from the bookstore. And because we also know the first date of the class, we actually monitor all that on behalf of the instructor, which they think is a real service and benefit to them, because many times the bookstore forgets or something drops through the cracks, and it isn't until the first day of class when they realize their students don't have their books.
So the PO is actually coming to you from the bookstore?
Yes, the purchase order comes to us from the bookstore.
Hmm.
So the only thing that the instructor needs to do is either email, we actually have them print a PO from our application,
right,
and they can email that to their bookstore or hand it to their bookstore.
Okay.
And then the order comes from the bookstore, and we track all of that and make sure that, you know, it can come in time to be in the bookstore when the students are coming through and getting their textbooks for the semester.
And the ways that those orders come from bookstores to you vary from faxes to phone calls to electronic transfers?
Absolutely.
Okay. So it's
still kind of, today, yes.
Yep.
We're amazed at how many still really come through fax.
Right. Are any coming through formalized web services of any kind?
Not directly to us, but possibly, you know, we use Ingram.
Right.
So sometimes they come through that mechanism.
Okay. All right, so then you've got the order from the store,
right?
And you pull the materials together out of the Safari database,
right? Actually, out of the system itself, as part of the process that the instructor goes through online, when they compile everything dynamically, they can sit there and we actually produce the printable PDF, and they can review it online to make
right.
sure that it's exactly what they want it to be,
right?
And then they finalize the order, and then that print-ready, print-on-demand PDF, digitized PDF, is then sent to the printer for printing and distribution once we get all the details from the purchase order.
Okay. And what is their turnaround on that?
Basically, our average is anywhere between 5 and 10 business days.
Okay.
You know, sometimes in real peak periods, that might go to 15 or 20, you know, like right before a fall semester. But so far, we've been pretty good at meeting that turnaround.
Okay. So then, at this point, you said it has an ISBN number. It's a book like any other in a certain sense. It could be that the student this year would turn around and sell it back to the used book market for use by a kid next year. I mean, it just falls into the same category as any other textbook, right?
Yes, it does, with a couple unique things. Number one, that we make it very easy for the instructors, because this is a fast-changing area, right? I mean, they're doing instruction in applications and things that come out with the newest versions a year later.
Mm-hmm.
So we make it very easy for them to copy that book project to a new draft project the next semester and delete sections they don't want out of it and add others,
mm-hmm.
And then republish with a new ISBN for the following semester.
Yeah, so it's actually in this model going to be somewhat less likely that a lot of stuff is going to flow through the used book channel the way that it used to, because things are easily changed and there are also good reasons to change them. So.
Well, and what we're hoping is because these compilations are very customized to the course itself, that the students find value in all of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what we interviewed students as well, and what they were telling us is, look, I had to buy this whole textbook because I needed to read 3 chapters out of it.
Yep.
And to me, that doesn't provide, you know, that's not going to take a place on my bookshelf
right.
Going forward because I don't see the value in it. Mm-hmm. But if you're compiling all of this stuff, every piece of which is relevant to what they're being taught,
yep.
you have much better chance for it finding a place on the reference shelf of folks who are going to get jobs in this area.
What's my access online to this custom book?
There are 2 ways that you can create projects on the Safari service. One is with a print textbook. The other is what we call an online syllabus. You could think of it as an online course reader. And what you can do is you can basically link to content from up to 10 titles, as well as any of the articles and things that we provide from our sites like Perl.com and XML.com. And basically, that's limitless in terms of the number of linkages and stuff you can provide. And we sell that to students directly via credit card, via subscription model, very similar to Safari Books Online,
mm-hmm.
For a timed access.
Mm-hmm.
So anywhere from 2 to 5 months, figure $10 a month, so $1 a book per month. So $19.99 to $49.99 for 5 months.
Okay.
And the way that we're finding folks using both of those facilities, John, is, for example, they're really trying to bring some good value to the students instead of paying, you know, $130 for a textbook, which is the average cost these days.
Yep.
So what they do is they create, you know, kind of a 150, 200 page primary, absolutely necessary reading print book. And that's the stuff that they want the student to walk away with and keep on the reference shelf.
Okay. And there won't necessarily be parallel access to that 250 pages online.
Exactly. And what they'll do is they'll create this syllabus of all the recommended reading
Right.
You know, because you know as well as I do that the students, we're lucky the students buy the primary textbook, let alone all the recommended reading, right?
Right.
So they put all the recommended reading in a syllabus, and they can, you know, they can have 1,000 pages of stuff in the syllabus piece because
right.
it's timed access.
But I can still use, if I want to use the online search as a way of locating something in the print book, I can at least do that, right? Boy, in so many ways, and this is just one of them, I would so love to be a college student today with the tools and the technologies that are available.
You know, my nephew said that to me when he graduated. He looked at me and said, "How did you ever go through school without the internet?"
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been, among other things, doing a bit of a refresher on population genetics because there are a number of lectures that are coming online now from places like Stanford and Berkeley.
Right.
And it really is causing me to rethink a whole bunch of things. You know, the notion of being in class for 50 minutes to absorb this lecture when I could be out on my bicycle absorbing that same lecture, you know, not as a substitute for the class time, but wouldn't I rather have heard the lecture and then shown up in class for the thing that face-to-face interaction with other people and the professor really ought to be about, which is, given that the content has been delivered and I've thought about it, now I've got these questions. Let's drill down on the points that I didn't understand so well, or let's have a follow-on conversation.
Right, or the instructor questioning the students to try and figure out whether or not they've comprehended it or not.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that, I actually know that this is going to trigger a sea change, and it's also going to be just incredibly threatening to a lot of people who are teaching now. I saw a little bit of this a couple of weeks ago. I was at a university and actually gave a keynote talk to their instructional technologist and faculty teams. We talked a little bit about these things, and you can see them starting to grapple with the idea that, wow, you know, there really are better ways for me to use my FaceTime with students than what we have been doing for all these years.
Well, and here's the real challenge that I've seen being out there, is that think about who the generation is right now in, you know, higher education that's teaching our students. These are not people traditionally that have been comfortable with technology. And so you have a real rub there of how do you get these folks to adopt these things? Like, for example, we're trying to go in and change the habits of, you know, computer science and information technology folks, right? You'd think at the very least that those would be the easiest folks to transition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you still get a lot of, you know, I've seen unbelievable things where they've come back even on our search and said, "Hey, I'm searching for this and I can't find anything." And you go look and look to see how they're searching
mm-hmm.
and what they're doing with search, which you would think is something, you know, at least in the higher education area, that they would be a little more literate about.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me. It's
yeah.
like, well, you might try and do, you know, this little thing, and it comes back with exactly the information you're looking for. But that's not true. And then you move that to history, geography, you know, people who are not prone to using technology in the first place.
Right.
And you really have a rub between the students coming up and their exposure and comfort with technology and those teaching.
Beyond that, there is a tendency for people to assume, well, anyone under the age of such and such just naturally groks all of this. And that's not true. There's a whole lot that kids high school and college age and beyond don't know about how to make the most effective use of the internet, how to search intelligently, how to, in all sorts of ways, operate effectively online. And there are strategies that aren't being taught because you know, the people who are doing the teaching aren't aware of those strategies. And so it's not only that the students are ahead of their teachers in some ways, but that there's no one to take them farther than where they are. And they need to be taken farther than where they are in a lot of ways. At the place where I was a couple of weeks ago, it was quite interesting to see that they're starting to deploy wikis as classroom tools, you know. But I asked the question, you know, for how many of the kids in your class was this a new experience? And they said, well, most of them, you know. So I mean, they have
wow.
they have a certain range of experience around IM and mm-hmm. MySpace and Facebook and things like that. But I think people tend to look at that and generalize it to, well, they're all completely, quote-unquote, computer literate. And my observation is that they are in relatively narrow ways, you know, that they don't, you know, that they're not being taught communication strategies, data management strategies, a whole lot of things that they ought to know.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If I had a kid that was in, you know, middle school to high school range right now, I would love to see as a part of, you know, right alongside the 3 R's, right, I would love to see 3 different topic areas be just absolutely required before they graduate from high school. One is typing.
Yeah.
Touch typing.
Yeah.
It was one of the best, you know, back when I was in school, of course, women just took typing, you know, while the guys took industrial arts. But I have to say, looking back, that was the best thing I could have done.
Me too. We did it in junior high school. And,
right. And then the second thing is search.
Yep.
Learning how I can find information on my own, because that is the best way to self-educate.
Yes.
And equipping them before they get out of high school with knowing how to find information and being the best searchers out there,
yes,
will absolutely equip them much better than their counterparts when they get out there. And then the third, in my mind, is personal finance.
Oh, God, yeah.
The fact that we don't have that as a, you know, yes, primary component of our educational system is just sad to me.
It's actually scandalous. Mm-hmm. You're right on all counts. And on the second one, a friend of mine here in New Hampshire who runs a software company, and I had dinner not long ago, and his point was he just hired a new programmer, and he said, you know, I don't care that he, quote-unquote, knows Java or this or that operating system or this or that database product, right? I mean, what I care about is that he can learn those things quickly.
Absolutely.
On demand.
Did you see recently the National Spelling Bee thing?
Yeah.
On ABC? What's fascinating to me is, you know, it's so applicable to, like, programming languages and everything else, because when you watch these kids, right, you can tell what they've studied.
Yeah.
And so there was that one girl who, you know, had studied French, and luckily she got, like, 5 out of her last 6 words were French root words, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the one I think she stumbled on was the German root word, or maybe it was the guy who stumbled on it. But anyways, the point is, it's like learning language is about learning the basics and the rule sets and those kinds of things that you need, and then you can derive and or learn the rest yourself,
mm-hmm,
right? Or assume the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to even programming languages, it's the same way. So once you learn a programming language, and preferably something in, you know, object-oriented or scripting or whatever you want, the fact that you can pick up other things, it should be readily apparent.
Yeah.
And it's the how do you teach yourself to do those other things,
exactly,
that I think is critical in the educational experience.
So I also wanted to talk a little bit about other modes of education, other modes of publishing, other modes of information transfer. As you know, I've been playing around with this screencast idea, and it's turned into a really interesting way to convey understanding about software products, technologies.
I'm a huge fan of it, and mainly because I'm a visual learner.
Uh-huh.
I mean, understanding my learning style and what works with me, you know, I'm not an audio type learner, I'm a visual learner.
Right.
And whether that's in text and reading and pictures, or whether that's someone showing me how to do something, I retain it, I absorb it, I whatever, much better than
yeah,
other forms.
Well,
of
you teaching. Mentioned Mark Logic. The way that I got going with Mark Logic was that I had had an interview with Jason Hunter.
Oh, Jason Hunter.
He yeah, had done a screencast demonstration of Mark Logic to me. And a couple of weeks later, I got hold of the product and was starting to learn how to program in XQuery for the first time. And I went back to that screencast again and again. And it was just a fascinating thing, because what he had done is he had done a mixture of demos and then flipping from the demo to a screen full of the code that was behind the demo. So when I got to places where I needed to do things, I remembered, well, what he showed me in the demo would have required a function that did this with an HTTP header, right? And so I know that I saw this in the demo, and then right after that, I saw the code. So I'll go to that place, and there it was. It was amazing.
And you know, it's interesting. I'm a very big fan of lynda.com, right?
You should say what that is, because not everybody will have heard of it.
Oh, it's lynda.com. And basically, lynda.com is a series, you know, we talked about atomized content, right?
Yep.
So she's broken down all the content from her books and things in 3 to 9 or 10 minute video snippets.
Mm-hmm.
And you can subscribe, you know, you can do a yearly subscription to this entire library of these video casts.
Right.
And where I find it the most useful is, you know, I've become quite a little prosumer, if you will, in terms of putting movies together and doing digital photography and other things. And when I go to manipulate photos or I go to do something, you know, in terms of digital movie making, I know that something can be done. For example, you know, let's say I've scanned in an old photo of a family member and it has a crease in it or it has, you know, some kind of aberration and I want to fix it.
Yeah.
I know that it can be fixed,
yeah.
But I don't necessarily remember all the Photoshop commands or anything else to do it. And so I search through the library, right, and I get the 3-minute VCast for it.
Yeah.
Call it just-in-time learning, right? So I go and I view that, and I go and apply that learning, and I fix it. And because we have to remember so much else these days, and God knows the older I get, the more I forget, I can also dump it off my stack, right?
Yep.
I've done it. I performed the task. I know where to go back and get
exactly.
the information. I don't need to retain that information
exactly.
anymore.
Exactly.
And it's fabulous. I mean, I find myself being able to do so much more and people being amazed at, oh, how did you know how to do that? Well, honestly, I didn't. I just found out just in time how to do it.
Yeah.
I applied it and then I dumped it.
Yeah, yeah. Another sort of formative experience along these lines for me was I had an old HP printer. A LaserJet Plus, I think, actually. And
oh my.
And right, a really ancient thing, but you know, they never die exactly. They just sometimes get sick. And so it got sick and I really basically just figured I should toss the thing at this point, you know, but I looked around and it turned out that the parts kit was inexpensive. It was like, you know, $50 for the part. It was a roller or something like that, you know. But I knew that there's no way that I was going to be able to execute that procedure. But I went to this place called fixyourownprinter.com.
And oh, really?
They sell the parts kits with a video, right? And I just, you know, set the video up. And I mean, I had to really pretty much totally disassemble this printer. And it was complex. And there's just absolutely no way that I would have been able to follow written instructions. But I had the scrubber on the video and I just, you know, went back and forth and worked my way through it, and I'll be damned. You know, it was remarkable.
Well, I'm sure you're familiar with our new magazine, Make Magazine.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the whole premise. It's like, you know, popular science for the 21st century. But in essence, the step-by-step, very picture-oriented, and they're starting to do VCast and stuff of project kits and things, is exactly, I mean, when somebody says hack on your TiVo, right,
mm-hmm.
you kind of, you know, I'm not the geekiest hardware person in the world, but if somebody can show me a little VCast or,
mm-hmm.
or give me a step-by-step instruction piece to it,
mm-hmm.
hell yeah, I'll take the cover off, I'll give it a try, especially if it's something that I really want to have happen. I think that whole trend and resurgence of that is really coming to the forefront.
So how do you see that getting woven together with the book stuff at some point?
I think multimedia is where the world is going. And like I mentioned, I think it has everything to do with learning styles.
Yeah.
I think the fact that I can customize my learning in the way that fits my style, that's the ultimate for me. So if I'm a real visual learner and I can choose between, you know, reading text or, you know, looking at lots of visual pictures to show me how to do something, or watching a video that shows me how to do something,
mm-hmm.
I can pick and choose the best content style or learning style that's right for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more and more, I definitely think VCasts are the next podcast generation, especially with you get more and more of the, you know, iPod video stuff and those kinds of players out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at iTunes U. I mean, they're starting to do the lectures being taped and things and being able to be provided to students. So you don't even need to go to the classroom experience to, you know, see the lecture of your instructor. I think more and more and more of that is going to be coming to the forefront. And the benefit to us as consumers of that is we get to choose what's best in regards to our learning style.
Yeah, I suppose that a lot of the bottleneck now is on the production side. In other words, if the stuff were available, people would be snapping it up. But, well, just to take our situation, I mean, it would be obvious at this point that an InfoWorld review of a software product should be demonstrating it with a screencast and an audio voiceover of the highlights. And outside of what I've done, that's yet to happen. And there are a variety of reasons for that. But frankly, one of them is I've spent quite a lot of time getting to the point where I'm able to do that stuff competently and reasonably efficiently in terms of time.
But what creates the tipping point? Our business models around increasing our motivation to do so.
Right.
Right. And I think that's the challenge. We're all struggling with different business models that would allow us to put the resources and put the effort and put the time towards creating those kind of archives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no small task.
No, it isn't.
As much as you can do it with nice little, you know, software and easy things on your Mac these days, it still takes time and effort, and that's really the limiting part of the equation.
There was a story in the New York Times a while ago. The title was, "Is Cinema Studies the New MBA?" And the idea was that the use of multimedia, for lack of a better word, communication tools is something that is moving out of purely the creative world and is moving into the business world as a what will increasingly be considered just a normal mode of communication along with what we've historically used to tell each other stories and to make presentations and to, you know, get our messages across to one another. And so this is a set of things that right now people like you and I will, you know, self-motivate and learn, but that, you know, we should probably expect to be part of, you know, the three R's.
Right. A lot to think about, that's for sure, when we're sitting in our, you know, rocking chairs in the old age home.
This was really fun.
Great. It was great to catch up with you again, John.
Yeah, thanks for doing this.